Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, good evening. It is January 9th, 2010. My name is Don Beaton, and I am the author of The Return Viewer's Guide. And tonight, I am going to be focusing on my Some Images page, which is located on my original website, returnviewersguide.ca. And first off, though, I would like to mention that I have a book out called The Return Viewer's Guide, and the website for that book is returnguidebook.ca. And if you happen to be in the Southern Ontario region in Canada, you can stop by Brian Prince Bookseller in Hamilton at 1060 King Street West, or if you're in the Mississauga area, you can stop by Booker's Bookstore in downtown Oakville on 172 Lakeshore Road East at brianprincebooks.net, bookersbookstore.ca. In the chat room, I have a link to the Some Images page. And so you can find the page that way, or you can go to returnviewersguide.ca, scroll down, and you'll see a list of the pages that I have back online. And so my Some Images page is an effort to try to describe the object that I saw crossing down in front of the moon, between the moon and the earth. And so I am not the artistic type, unfortunately. And so I have had to do sort of a compilation or collection of various images and descriptions in order to try to describe this object, whether it be in my viewer's guide itself, or I do five separate guides, and together it's my hope that they'll provide a very, very good picture for whoever's interested in knowing ahead of time what happens. And I just add more detail and talk about various aspects, and no one single guide covers it all sort of idea. And it's the same with my Some Images page. I can thank my friend Nathan for supplying the clay that day that Nathan and I got together. And I have a pipe cleaner, styrofoam balls, wire, and a pencil and paper, and a website. And if you have a look at these images, you will see that they are all basically very simple and even, I would say, crude, especially the drawing part where I actually draw. But in general, starting right at the top and with image number one, the basic flight path, my images actually are accurate to whatever point as far as overall shapes and overall depiction is concerned. Certainly not 100%. And I try to clarify what you're seeing on this page when you look at these images. And that is how I dealt with trying to describe this object's appearance. I describe in the viewer's guide a lot about its appearance, and I also do here as well. The viewer's guide is mainly to do with behavior and describing the event itself. And this page does touch on that as well. But this page really is an effort to try to provide a basic description of the object and then some clarification. When you look at these images, what is it supposed to mean, or what is it supposed to be, kind of thing. And it is brief on one hand. On the other hand, I do get into some detail. I try to explain in terms that make sense to me, what it is this page represents. And this definitely needs to be updated. I read through this actually the other day, at least 70 or 80% of it, and there's certainly some things I need to change and update. And what I'll do is probably come back to this page again one day once those updates are in place. But for now, I thought it was important to look at this page and basically get that basic description out there and on the record for people to listen to. And certainly, like I've just mentioned, if you've looked at my viewers' guides or listened to the audio archives here at Blog Talk Radio, you do know a lot about what the object looks like. Excuse me while I take a water break. Thank you. The ancient object returns and rolls down from the region of space above and to the left of the moon. The object first covers the moon's upper left corner as seen from Earth. The object slowly rolls forward in the direction that it is traveling. The object is traveling at a tremendous speed and is only within the distance of the moon's orbit for a very short few minutes at the most. The forward rolling object travels towards the viewer's lower right as it travels down past the Earth's horizon towards and eventually through the area of space below and beside the sun. The object's color matches the brightest areas of the moon. Now, I just read some text that is located to the left of image 1, and now I'm moving to the right of image 1 at the top of my Some Images page located on returnviewersguide.ca. The crossing angle shown is generally accurate. However, the left to right angle shown is very probably slightly high. Now, what I'm doing is I'm referring to the basic flight path image, image number 1, and you will see that located centrally in the page. And so I will mention, I'll go back and read that again. So I'm looking at the basic flight path image, which is actually overall very accurate. The crossing angle shown is generally accurate. However, the left to right angle shown is very probably slightly high. The top to bottom sink rate is accurate in general. So I've mentioned about high angle, low angle. I think that when I'm looking at this, when I said the crossing angle shown is very probably slightly high, that would, what I'm trying to say is that when you look at that arrow in front of the sphere, it may be pointing too far out wide, and that's what I'm thinking of when I say high, the angle increasing, and it should be maybe pointed a bit more towards you, so as if the object would just come a little bit closer, almost the way the end of the pipe cleaner, as it turns out, is curved slightly. That represents just a slightly less angles, at least as far as I interpret it. But you can see from this image, in general, the sink rate, the way the object is crossing, rolling down across in front, and moving from left to right. Image number 1, the styrofoam ball is not intended to illustrate the actual shape of the object. The pipe cleaner is not 100% straight. The moon is shown in the background. This image does not illustrate or attempt to show the actual way the light from the moon looks at this present point in a return during the object's crossing, is how I would probably word it now. Image number 1 illustrates the location where the moon's changed light emerges from over the object's upper right horizon and to the right of the object after the total eclipse. And the caption for image number 1 reads, "Even though the object crosses at a point well out in front of the moon towards the Earth, it also crosses at a point that is well out from the Earth towards the moon. I am mentioning this point because I realize that this point can can help a person to better understand the image, the basic flight path. And that gets into distance and size and scale. Very, very hard areas to nail down. Very, very difficult. But there, a huge point here is that I know for a fact the object crosses at a point well towards the Earth because of the way it's so much clearer than the Moon. It's just crystal clear. And through the telescope, it couldn't be more in focus. Whereas when you're looking at the Moon, you're trying to get the best possible overall focus and the best possible look and the biggest image you can pretty much fit in your viewfinder, all that stuff. And in comparison, the Moon appears blurry in comparison to the object as far as how clear is one compared to the other. So I take that, and it helps me to understand that this object is crossing at a point that is well out in front of the Moon. And with the amount of time it takes to cross while it's actually in between the Moon and the Earth, and the way it actually does cross, it helps me to understand that this object is not skimming across just above the atmosphere or anything when it finally does pass by the Earth. This object is crossing well out from the Earth towards the Moon. Sort of, I would guess, probably closer to the Moon than the Earth, but there's a guess. It does cross well out from the Earth. So this is not something that you're going to see in the atmosphere or just above it. This object crosses well out. And that's a major point. And that's also a point that can help you understand the basic flight path image, because this is trying to illustrate the view out of a telescope. So this is obviously not how it looks to you when you're looking with the naked eye. Now, image number two is an image that shows the styrofoam ball behind the object to the right of the raised mound area, and that's representing where the changed light comes from. The very reflective object is many times brighter than the more distant, dimmer Moon. Looking through a small backyard telescope, a normal, clear, in-focus view of the Moon seems blurry in comparison to the crystal clear, very in-focus view of the returning object. Future viewers will be stunned and surprised by the clarity of the details that are visible and very easily seen on the object's surface. The object is incredibly brilliant, however, in spite of the tremendous brightness of the object, it is not uncomfortable to look at. And it is very bright, but it doesn't hurt your eye like a bright light. It's very reflective, and the sun is reflecting directly off of it. But it doesn't hurt, similar to looking at a bright light, or certainly looking at the sun. This experience is not like looking at the brightness of the sun with the associated pain that you'll feel in your eye. And there is a point there where, for me, when I was first seeing this object, I know for a fact that I suddenly was aware that I could keep looking at it and that I wasn't feeling pain. And I'm going from a dark environment to looking through a telescope that is lit up inside by the brightness of the surface of this object. And the caption to the right of image number two. In image number one, in general, the scale and or sizes of the object and the Moon relative to one another as seen from the Earth during the object's crossing is depicted or shown accurately. And that's in general. Like it's in the ballpark, and it could be there could be a lot of difference compared to the way I depict it. But past whatever point, within a certain area, at least this depiction is accurate. But is it still in general? In image number one, in general, the scale and or sizes of the object and the moon relative to one another, as seen from the Earth during the object's crossing, is depicted or shown accurately. And this is something that has to be remembered here in the basic flight path image. This wasn't an attempt to show the size of the object as compared to the moon in the background when it's crossing in front and obscuring it. It does obscure the sight of the moon. The moon's disk is obscured once again. But this image is an attempt to show the basic flight path. So when I was doing this, that was the point for me. It wasn't about showing the two objects together. Because, of course, when I finally did see the moon's light again, it was all changed, and I was looking at the normal view of the moon. I'm just really, on a basic level, this image is simply about the flight path of the object. And in that sense, it is actually very accurate. You will see that this is the way the object rolls by. It's a forward-rolling object. Just an incredible sight. And as a kid, for me, it really looked like the object rolled at the right speed relative to its actual speed. It really looked like it could have been on a smooth surface rolling down. It was the roll matched the forward speed, as at least that's how it appeared. Now I realized that it was traveling through space at many, many thousands of miles an hour, and certainly the forward roll rate couldn't possibly match up with the actual speed it was traveling at. It would be much slower if it was like actually in contact with the surface. I'm sure you wouldn't even be able to see it for the way it would spin forward at a tremendous speed. This object, when you compare it to the background of space, when you see it rolling down, it looks very natural, like it's actually rolling down a ramp in comparison to the stars and the whole scene. It looks right. And as a kid, it just seemed to me natural that that's what it was doing. And it never even occurred to me that it was actually orbiting the way it was. I really thought it was rolling. And that's what it looks like. So it's a stunning effect where it really does look like it matches up and is rolling at the right rate compared to its forward motion. And there's where size, speed, and scale is totally thrown off by looking through a telescope or looking at huge celestial objects at tremendous speeds out in space. It's very hard to put it in proper perspective. But the perspective that you do get is that it could very well be rolling down a ramp or something. That's kind of the effect. And as a kid, these are the kinds of thoughts that went through my mind. And once again, I believe I saw this object the night of May 18th, 1970, Mr. W. Spill reported the object obscuring the moon's disk the night of May 24th, 1926. And according to that time frame and according to the way the background of space is all in place the night of May 22nd, 2013, with Spica and associated other double stars, we're looking at it at a very, very high probability that the object that I saw and describe on my websites and in my book is, in fact, going to be back that night. And a quick point about my book, all the content within my book is free online. You don't have to buy my book to read my content or to read my information. My book is for sale for people who are interested in what I call a historic souvenir. That's what it actually is. And I'm very, very happy to be able to do a book and have something out there for people to purchase and for myself and my family. To have something like this to hold in our hand is fantastic. And for other people, I hope that it's something that you can keep with you well into the future. And the night of the return, you should definitely already know the details, and you won't need to be referring to the book. And certainly, there's no time for that. But I want to thank Chad Lilly at Rev Press He's the publisher of the book. He helped out and contributed many ways, and I can't quite list them all here for you. I am going to do a show specifically on the book, but I just want to quickly point out that I do have a book out, but the content is not actually the point as far as the sale of the book is concerned. The content's all free online, but you can buy a book, and I am going to try my best to sign as many books as possible into the future, and there'll be other books as well. I have a project in the works right now, but in the meantime, I did see the object, and my book that describes this will be a collector's item one day, certainly. This is a historic event every time the object crosses in front of the moon, and I am able to describe it by a simple lucky fluke. I saw the object crossing down, and this is all part of my attempt to get the right information out there for people so they can understand ahead of time some basic points and details related to the return of the crossing ancient object. And the ancient name that I choose to use for the object, because it makes so much sense for me and just fits and feels right for me, is Adoyle. And Adoyle will return. And I am describing Adoyle on this page to you. Other people have other names for it. There are many, many names for this ancient object. And they're all correct. There's no correct name. There's no one single correct name. Now, maybe in the future it'll be referred to as the whatever object is going to be called, whatever the name is going to be for people. You know, people may settle on something type thing, but a lot of people are going to go right to the name their ancient ancestors used, and that'll be the name for them. And it's correct. Every name is correct, and everyone has the chance to name it for themselves, make it your family tradition. I've named the valley after my children, and I use the ancient name Adoyle because it's a match for me. Image number 2 shows a brownish clay model in front of a white styrofoam ball. There is a very high probability that the object's raised surface feature is more centrally located compared to the way my clay models show the object's raised surface feature located to the left. I modeled the object according to the way I remember it to be. It may be very possible that the light blending and merging that occurs between the light from the moon and the light from the object's upper right horizon, and especially, I threw something in there and I didn't need to. So I'm going to back up, and just to the right of image number 3, I modeled the object according to the way I remember it to be. It may be very possible that the light blending and merging that occurs between the light from the moon and the object's right horizon, and especially the object's upper right horizon, has caused me to remember the shape of the object in a slightly distorted to the right fashion. And I am only talking about the time during this event when the changed light from the moon is visible in the right area and upper right area. Before that point, my memory is of a perfectly spherical object rolling towards me, basically, slightly taller the way it rolls. And once the raised area came into view, I really wasn't looking to see where it was located. I was just looking at it, and I was looking down the left side of the object, but I wasn't looking down the right side of the object because you can't see down the right side of the object. And so when I did look to the right, the change light from the moon in the background of space was there. And to the right of the overhang, or as I describe it at this later point, as the object rolls forward, everything just is stretched out to the right. So it was, this is the way I remember the object, and distorted to the right, and which is very hard to explain to people, but that describes it. I sincerely believe that my models are distorted to the right, but who knows? It's actually possible that that could reflect actually the real shape of the object. It could be that the object's raised area is located to the left, but there's an area where I have to guess, because that is something I just simply don't know. So, because of the complicated nature of seeing the right side of the object, I really think there's a very good chance that this has caused me to remember the shape of the object in a slightly distorted to the right fashion. And now to the left of image number 3, which is the same image located on my homepage at the top that shows 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 clay models and the side profile of the object. To the left of image number 3, the object is nearly completely covered with hundreds of craters. All of the craters have what looks like pieces of the object's surface crust standing vertically around all of the craters. Vertically standing crater rim pieces tower upwards to tremendous heights. Even the smallest of these craters are actually very large in size and scale. And this will, I am 99.95% certain, will prove to be the case. In fact, I've been thinking about this the last couple of days and trying to dig up some things that I wrote, and people are going to be absolutely blown away when they see how huge these crater rim pieces are. These, when humans put up the standing stones for their standing stone crater, they found the biggest stones that they could find in many, many cases. And there are smaller versions of standing stone circles too. But big stones were probably like prestigious to have in a circle. That would be more realistic for people. The bigger the stones that they could find, the better, because that's comes closer to actually modeling the rim pieces correctly. I know my guesses, which people would certainly laugh at and say, impossible. But I am certain that my guesses will fall well short of the actual height of these crater rim pieces. When you look at it on a planetary scale, these rim pieces are massive. And these craters themselves are all different diameters. There's big ones, small ones, all sorts in between. But they're all exactly the same. All of them are ringed by the standing rim pieces. And that's guaranteed. You will not see a lunar-type crater on this object. There are none. Even though I may not have seen 100% of the object's surface area, I'll take a chance on that, and I'll make that statement. And the odds are very, very, very high in my favor that, in fact, there isn't even a vertically standing crater rim piece missing from any of these hundreds of craters, and they're all intact and all standing straight up all around these craters, and each crater has all of its crater rim pieces. There aren't like missing pieces here and there. I know in all likelihood that'll be true. Now, it's actually possible there might be a crater that's missing one or two crater rim pieces somewhere on the object, but I didn't see that. Every single crater that I saw was neatly ringed perfectly with vertically standing rim pieces. So as you go through this and you try to imagine an object that is the same color as the brightest areas of the moon, and in this shape, behaving the way it's behaving, and then you can always just skip down to the very last one there and have a look at my attempt at standing stone circles, or standing crater rim pieces, throw that in on the surface of the object everywhere, and you start to get a picture of what this object looks like. And this is an accurate picture. The only problem I have with image number 7 or image number 8 is there is a crater that is a little bit too high, located too close to the shadow from below. I think that where you see the 3 or 4 craters going right across the surface, and then that's really as far as they go towards that area. There are no craters up this slope under the overhang, and the crater rim, the crater that I show on the top of the mound, is probably too far forward. It should be moved back just slightly, and all this area is crater free. And I probably should fix these images to reflect that, but I leave a big space there where there's no craters. I just think the one's just up just a bit too high. But there are no craters in this area in the front part of the mound where it eventually becomes the overhang. But everywhere else on this object, except on the sides, in the middle and the sides, the areas of highest centrifugal force, we'll say, all have craters except for this upwards area before the mound and the sides. And of course, the sides don't have the highest centrifugal force, obviously. So I am moving up the page to image number 4, and we'll get some repeated details here because I haven't actually looked to see what's next here directly, and I am trying to elaborate as I go. To the left of image number 4 on my Some Images page on returnviewersguide.ca, the turning side of the object that partially faces towards the Earth has no craters. All of the various size craters are exactly the same type of crater. All of the craters are ringed by vertically standing crater rim pieces. I only saw this one type of crater. There are no craters that look even remotely close to the way a typical lunar crater or moon crater looks. The large surface areas between craters are smooth. Some crease mark indentation lines show similar parallel, long curving line patterns in the areas between the craters. And to the right of image number 4, which is a different perspective on these models. And you can see my object with a pipe cleaner through it. And then you can see to the lower right of image number 4, a more straight-on view of the object, and that may put the centrally located mound area with the overhang more in the correct area of the object. And this effect is because of the way the camera angle here. And if you look at that same clay model in image number 5, you'll see that the right side of it does have the mound on it, and the left side is sort of distorted to the right. But the way it appears in image number 4 puts it in the middle. And then same with the image on the left bottom side of image number 4. And the image on the left side of the lower left corner of image number 4 reminds me very much of a image that is on a clay pot of some type, either Incan or Mayan or Maya clay pot, and or sphere, a ball or something. There's a fella down in South America somewhere, or possibly Central America, who has a whole collection of these items, and there's some fantastic paintings on them. And one of them shows a chief or a warrior holding up what looks like a telescope, and he's looking at the object, and you can actually see the shape of the object with the shadow. And I think that's a stunning depiction, and I'll have to link to it one day. But that's that image number 4, the image in the bottom left and bottom right look very, very similar. not surprisingly, to that image. When I saw it right away, I knew exactly what it was. And people are actually even able to understand that he's looking at a celestial object. The way it's shown in this depiction, it's clear that it's something in space. And it is the object from the front with the shadow underneath the overhang. To the right of image number 4, the images on this page do not depict or illustrate the objects or the moon's scale or relative sizes with complete 100% accuracy. After modeling the object from the front position, the way the object is viewed in image number 2, the side profile of the object that is eventually seen or viewed from the Earth is shown in image number 3. Accurate brightness and colors are not depicted or shown anywhere on this page. To the right of image number 5, the object's surface area between craters has some crease marks. As described, the object is nearly completely covered with craters. However, no attempt has been made to depict craters or crease marks using the clay models. To the left of image number 5, the object is smaller than the moon. However, when the object crosses between the Earth and moon, the moon is completely eclipsed or covered. I say the object's smaller than the moon. How much smaller? I can't tell you. I don't know. It covers the moon. So it is definitely a place of very, very huge distances and large, large surface areas. And when you see from close, you know you're looking at something very big. No one's going to look at this object and brush it off as just some kind of an insignificant near-Earth object going by, you know, like one recently that was in the neighborhood. And I'm going to do a show on that. And in comparison, this object is... there's just no comparison. We're talking about the difference between a locomotive and a speck of dust on the track. This object is a huge object, and it's simple as that. People are going to be absolutely stunned when they see the size of this object. As the forward rolling object travels towards the viewer's lower right, the object's large raised surface feature emerges from over the object's upper horizon and travels towards the viewer. The moon's light emerges to the right and above the object's upper right horizon. As the raised feature continues forward and down, it develops into a curving cliff and then gradually an overhang. There are no craters in the region directly under the overhang. And image number 6 is the side profile of the object again. That's the largest clay model I have, and that's a depiction, or rather, this object's in a position where, if it was rolling forward, the raised area is past top dead center, and is on its way down. And the effect from the front, when you're looking at it, is the raised area becomes a steep curving cliff and then becomes an overhang. And you are definitely realizing and focusing on this area just because you're seeing something happening there. The sun is located behind the viewer, and that would be the case in May 18th, 1970, when I believe I saw the object, 3 nights before the full moon. And we went out to look at the moon that night with the telescope, and it was, for all intents and purposes, it was a full moon. But as it turns out, May 24th, 1926 is 3 nights before the full moon, and that's when Mr. W. Spill reported the object. So there's where I get my 3 nights before the full moon, May 18th, 1970. I know the year already, and I just didn't know the month or day. Based on his description and then comparison with the background of space, it's clear that May 18th was more than likely the night that I saw the object. And then that same background in space is present two nights before the full moon, this time, May 22nd, 2013. So if you look back in time, you can see that the object sometimes is here three nights before the full moon, and then it's here. We go to a certain point, and it's here two nights before the full moon. And also, as has been, as a colleague and I have discovered, there are also lunar eclipses in association with this, where the Earth's shadow actually is crossing the face of the moon at a point really, really close to the return of the object. So it's there's also eclipses thrown in there on occasion, which really, really raises many questions. The sun is located behind the viewer. As the object's raised surface feature continues forward and down, the developing overhang continues to become more pronounced. Suddenly, a very black shadow appears located under the overhang, and I call it the black spot of the shadow. The black spot of the shadow spreads and continues to spread and thicken and gather in more of the area up under the overhang as the object's forward rolling motion continues. Image number 7, to the right of it. In image number 7, I've made no attempt to show the crease marks that are seen on the object's surface as I try to describe. The curving lines that are a part of image number 7 are simply an attempt to illustrate the overall shape of the object. Image number 7 is an attempt to illustrate the way the overall shape of the object becomes distorted and exaggerated once the moon's changed light. The scene of the valley, the site of the valley, is seen to the right, and when the black spot of the shadow appears under the newly formed and slowly developing, evolving overhang. Excuse me for a second. Thank you. The object's normal spherical snail shape becomes exaggerated and very pronounced after the tilting instead of rolling effect that the viewer starts happening, as I try to describe on the return viewer's guide for use of the small backyard telescope page. In image number 8, the changed light from the moon is shown, but only in a basic and very crude way. Also, once again, the scale of various elements is not depicted accurately. To the right and upper right, the moon's changed light becomes spread out, wide, and deep. An incredible expanse of sight is seen. A sight that looks exactly like a valley. It turns out that the object does cause the sight of the ancient valley of old to occur. The moon's light does become the famous ancient valley, as every viewer will be seeing for themselves very soon. Now, if you go back up to image number 7, the first part of the valley that I show is done much better than in image number 8. The angle that the edges travel away from the object are shown very accurately. So this would create a triangle shape. So if you continued in image number 7 up at the top, where the mountains, what I'm trying to show as mountains, is the edge of the changed light from the moon. That line of mountains continues and would stop somewhere in the very far distance. And then same with the bottom. Mountains that are facing in the way I show them are heading out across this way. But since you're looking at the scene from above the object, as I've described, you see as if out of a remote camera. Once you start to look at this, you see from above the object's surface. So when you look from there out straight into the valley, the mountains on the left and the mountains on the right are both oriented vertically and look correct. You're not looking at upside down mountains. You're seeing from above the object out into the valley and then eventually from in the depths of the valley. So the mountains are looking exactly like mountains. And I look to the base of the mountains on the left, and I look between the distant mountains in the distance, because there's a third line of mountains connecting these two. So there's like a triangle shape in the valley floor area, and that's where the flat white cloud effect is seen. And so it looks correct because you're not seeing from where you're standing on Earth. You're seeing from a place above the surface of the object. And already you're seeing the way the changed light lets you see. You're looking at the object, and then you're looking to the right, and it's as if you're looking from above the surface of the object, out straight out into the valley, with mountains on the left and on the right and across in the distance. And that's how the light allows you to see. That's the first time you're looking towards a place and then looking out from there. Okay. So to the left of image number 7, at a certain critical point, the shadow very suddenly drops or leaps downwards to the valley floor below the object's surface, directly below the overhang. The object itself, although moving and rolling forward, becomes a natural part of the entire scene. Somehow, because of the light blending and merging between the object's surface and the moon, incredibly, the object's moving, rolling surface becomes part of the entire scene. The object becomes the left end of the valley. Once the shadow has reached down to the valley floor, directly below the overhang, the surface of the object, the shadow instantly starts movement to the right across the surface of the object. Also, the shadow travels across the surface of the object away from the viewer on an angle that steadily increases as the slowly sinking object continues crossing between the Earth and Moon from the left to the right. The very fast-moving shadow's awesome wave is a tremendous, spectacular sight that I try to describe in various places within the pages of this website. First, the main group of tall, individual, obelisk-shaped shadows travel over and off the object's upper right horizon, then the big, thick wave of the shadow travels off the object's upper right horizon into the changed light from the moon, the ancient valley. And then I make a point here for details and descriptions concerning the sights and events that are seen on the object's surface and eventually in the distance of the moon's changed and then suddenly lasting light. Refer to the following pages for a starting point. Return viewer's guide for use with a small backyard telescope and the page The Awesome Good. And I don't have The Awesome Good online at this point. I am going to be putting it back up soon. Excuse me. And there is where I do describe in exact detail what you see as far as the shape of The Awesome Good is concerned, with his muscular back and the way he looks, and then his group of companions that are shaped and created by the other shadows in the main group of shadows, and I describe exactly what they look like, and everybody knows exactly what they look like, and when I tell you here on Blog Talk Radio, or you read it on my pages, it'll be just one more thing that you won't be able to believe, and that's absolutely fine. If I was just hearing this for the first time and someone was going to tell them or describe what the Awesome Good looks like, the crowd of other figures, I just would think this is just too bizarre. This can't be true. And that's okay. That's all part of it. This isn't about me trying to convince you this is true or provide proof for you. I saw what happens, and I'm describing what happens, and you can hear the idea of it, and then beyond that, you can hear some more details, and the further you go, the more you listen and the more you read, the more details you'll hear, the more details you'll read, and as you progress, there's there's just no way you're suddenly going to start to get it and go, oh yeah, this is true, you know, believe it. No, you're not going to believe it, and that's not the point. You will know that this is true one day. However, in the meantime, you can hear more details of what happens and what you see by listening to my show here on Blog Talk Radio over the next months and years, and also by reading on my returnviewersguide.ca website, where I have descriptions of this event. And you'll hear more without realizing that it's true. You'll hear the very accurate details I provide. And are like everybody else. Nobody believes this, okay? So that's fine. And that's on one hand. On the other hand, people who understand the solar system, scientists, geologists, and even some ancient history people, but especially the people that are working in our day looking at things that are relevant to us today, do know that their models work much better if they include this object. This object is the missing thing for them. And when they include it, and when they consider it, especially when you look at the Apollo detection or NASA's anomaly, when this object crossed in front of the moon, it blocked the signals from the instruments that Apollo crews left. NASA knows the exact time of this event, and I'm describing what happens during those seconds, and it works. It definitely works. You run any solar system model and insert this in the way I describe it, everything works better. And I know that there's a lot of head shaking going on out there, not because they think this is crazy, but they think that some people are realizing that their stuff works better for them, and they're shaking their heads because they can't believe that something like this could be responsible. You know, I didn't just dream this up. I've spent basically almost 40 years trying to understand this and going from really, really being behind the eight ball, not even knowing I was seeing changed light or that this was even unknown, to the point now where I have a grasp on it and I can draw a picture and I can describe it. And I can speculate, and I can guess too. And I know that it's impossible to believe. And once I realized that people believing wasn't the point, it became very easy for me to suddenly say, okay, now, well, I shouldn't say very easy, but in comparison to not being able to do anything and being basically paralyzed, it was easy suddenly to do something. And so I started to work at it and eventually learn how to talk about it, because I never would just say what it was. I would never say that the awesome good was a he before. I would never even mention the awesome good. I just wasn't capable of it because it's just too hard. Well, I can now, and you can see the awesome good too. And so I have sort of found a niche for myself. I am able to realize that anyone can see this if they look up at the right time. And for everyone who sees, for that person, it's as if they're the one who's going face to face. And it's hard to realize that the guy across the street or across the continent or across the ocean could also be going face to face. And for him, it's as if he's the one being noticed. This can happen the same way for everyone, as if they're the only person looking. And when the awesome good gets up and turns around and looks at you, he looks at you. And that's how it is. It feels that way. And you see that way. And I have come to understand how you can see in the light and how you move within it. And I can't say I can explain how, but I can describe the effect where you see as if out of a remote camera, and you can see around a corner. You can at first glance, you're looking from one at something, and then the next time you blink and look in a different direction, you're looking out from that place and at when whichever direction you happen to look in. It's kind of like you're in control within the changed light, and you can see any which way you want and from anywhere. And you know, these are things that I experienced but wasn't able to describe or talk about, or certainly wasn't willing to talk about, because of course as soon as people hear, they don't want to hear, and you know, you definitely feel like you're on the outside. So I've had experiences where very few people can continue with me on this, because it's too hard. All of a sudden, if what I'm saying is true, then well, what are the implications of that? Like, I mean, this gets too hard really fast. Well, I saw the object and I describe it, and many people want to know more, and as soon as they start to find out more, they immediately don't want to know anymore. And I know the effect that they're experiencing. At least I can imagine that effect, and to me it's completely understandable. And I'm sure it would have, hearing this from someone else, for me, it would probably have the same effect on me. For one, I wouldn't believe it unless I saw it for myself. Well, there's a huge point. You can see this for yourself, and that is going to be the only point. That'll be the very first point in time that you'll suddenly find yourself even close to believing that this could be true, is when you're on the verge of seeing. You'll actually probably have to see the object for yourself first before you can even start to move in the direction of to the point where you can actually consider this. Well, soon enough, this is all going to be happening. And that, on one hand, is very hard for me because I know what's going to happen. And I'm describing it to you. Well, this is what happens. And it happened safely last time. But that doesn't mean that it's not something that causes me apprehension. I know for me, there's tons of apprehension related to this event. And I know there's very little I can do about it. If there's a downside, I want people to know as much about this as possible, because if this is a situation where we really have to batten down the hatches, you know, have a real day off for everybody, where we quite literally shut things down in preparation, you know, this would be what the kind of event that would warrant such treatment. You know, and if there is a downside, if we've done a little bit of battening the hatches down, then perhaps the downside might not be so bad. So there's a huge motivation for me, is if I can lessen the whatever possible negative effects might come from this just by mentioning it, then I have to. And that's just a one basic point. I've talked about my responsibility in this area. There are many, many reasons why I have a responsibility. Whether people can believe the details I describe or not, I have to say to myself, okay, I still have to do this because it's too important to just sit on and not say anything about. And I know now that many people have read, I've tracked my web stats since 2005, and I know for a fact that there are tens of thousands of people who have read my pages. This is some small comfort for me, because now I know for a fact it's out there. People there's a lot of very important people aware of my descriptions. And the more that the person is into the earth sciences and space sciences, the more of an impact my descriptions have on them. Because, like I said, the people who are actually really working in this field are finding out that my descriptions make their models work better. And that's because it's a solar system. And if you have the right parts, the right pieces in place, it works like clockwork. Well, they know there's something missing. They know there's something they don't understand. And so there's my goals, at least in part, accomplished. The more people that hear about this, the better. And the more people in those types of positions that hear about this, the better. So my responsibility is to, one of my responsibilities is to continue to do this, to continue to talk about the details of what happens as a way to help do the right thing. And that's what it's about for me, for the sake of my family, and myself and my conscience. I have to try to do the right thing. So I really sincerely hope I'm on the right track. And thank you very much for joining me tonight. I look forward to next time. It is, once again, January 20th, 2010. Good night, folks. Bye for now.